Okay, good. Good morning. Let me also thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here and to present some recent work. So this is going to be mostly a Blackboard talk, and I'll only spend a few minutes in the beginning to show some data, which presumably many of you have seen already, but just in case, I will present them again. So this is based on work that I did recently together, the theoretical part with Leonid Glasmann and two students from Berlin, Yang Peng and Falko Pienka. Pienka is already done, and Falko is already done, and Yang is still pursuing his PhD. And a second paper, there was another postdoc, Yuval Winkler, involved. And then I will just barely mention, but I will not go into any details, presumably for lack of time. There's also an experimental paper that we were sort of cheerleaders on by colleagues in Berlin, Katharina Franke and her group, that also did experiments on chains of magnetic ad atoms. And I might say a few words about the conclusions of that experiment, but again, I probably won't have time to go into any details. So Yang Peng was actually giving me a stern reminder that I should summarize what the main questions and open questions are in the field at the beginning of the talk. And basically, this talk just has one question, and that is whether this recent experiment from Princeton in Ali Yazdani's group did observe Majorana bound states or not. And I will do this in two ways. Basically, the first question is whether the data are actually consistent with Majorana bound states. And the second question is whether they are, in some sense, simple experiments that one can do that go beyond what has already done that might probe this deeper than was done in this experiment. I'm not sure that I will answer the question in the end. In some sense, we will still have the same question in the end, but hopefully at a more informed level than in the beginning. Anyway, so let me briefly walk you through what Ali and his colleagues did. This is also had a lot of theory support and by Andre Brnovic and Alan MacDonald. So what they looked at was a system in which you take a set of magnetic ad atoms, iron in this case, and produce a chain of them. They like to do this spontaneously. You don't have to move the atoms. If you do the right sort of annealing, then they form these chains automatically. And you put this chain on a superconducting substrate, which is a lead-110 surface in this particular case. And so here are some pictures of these chains on this lead surface. So here's a scale bar. This is 20 nanometers. So roughly, the typical length of these chains is 20 nanometers. Then there are typically these blobs, clusters of iron atoms in the beginning, where it's not really just a chain, but more of a 2D cluster. And then sometimes there are chains also sticking out the other end of that cluster. There can also be more than one cluster. There's all kinds of possibilities. But the typical length scale of these chains is roughly 20 nanometers. So why would this be a reasonable system to look for Majorana bound states? Well, the simple reason is that it just has these three ingredients that by now are well understood to be the ingredients of the recipe to produce Majoranas. The first one is that it has magnetic ad atoms, and the experiment seems to show that these magnetic ad atoms order ferromagnetically. So presumably, there's strong spin polarization of the electrons along the chain. So we are close to sort of this simple Kitaev chain of a spin-polarized D-wave superconductor. It also has superconductivity because it's sitting on a superconducting substrate. So you have superconductivity induced along this chain by proximity. And the third ingredient that one needs, because strong spin polarization and S-wave superconductivity sort of are frustrating one another, the third ingredient that one needs in order to get the right P-wave sort of correlations in this chain is this strong spin-orbit coupling, and that is present in the system because the superconductor is lead, which is a heavy element, so there's presumably strong, relatively strong spin-orbit coupling present there, so you can actually get this P-wave superconducting order. So it's quite natural to expect that this is a good system for Majorana bound states. So what do they actually observe? And the other nice thing about this experiment, of course, is that this chain is exposed at the surface, so you can readily access it by scanning tunneling microscopy and have both energy resolution and spatial resolution. And so this is what this scanning tunneling spectroscopy data look like. These different traces are offset and correspond to different positions along the chain. And if you are at the end of the chain, then, so here's sort of some sort of indication of a gap. And if you're at the end of the chain, then there's a zero bias peak, and there are additional finite energy peaks also. If you go away from the end of the chain, so 6, 5, 4, then the zero bias feature is rapidly going away, whereas these finite energy peaks do remain and persist all the way through the chain. The scale going from one measurement to the other is roughly on the order of a nanometer, so you see that this zero bias peak is localized on the scale of roughly one nanometer, and I'll get back to that in a second. So here are sort of color plots of the same thing. If you look at zero bias, you see that the intensity is localized at the end of the wire, whereas at finite energies, it gets more and more delocalized.
Question?
Yes.
So the first line you say is a ferromagnetic.
Yes.
Is that an experimental fact?
Yes, and I'm not going to discuss it very much, and I'll just take it from experiment that is, so they do spin polarized STM, so they have spin polarized tips, and from the sort of from those measurements, of they conclude that it's ferromagnetically ordered. The reason that I added it here is that, first of all, it's important, and secondly, there was initially the expectation that possibly it would be would have helical order. There are some experiments from the Wiesentanger group for iron on iridium, if I remember correctly, where they claim that it would have some sort of helical order along the chain, and that would be very nice because then you don't need the spin-orbit coupling. Basically, the helical order is equivalent to having spin-orbit coupling in the system, but that doesn't seem to be the case in this experiment.
Yeah, so because this is some 1D
right.
system at a finite temperature.
Right, but it's only 20 nanometers, so the hope would it's probably not long range order, you're right.
There's also anisotropy.
And there's anisotropy, but
stabilizers.
Right, but still 1D, even at finite temperatures, that may not be enough.
What's about, can you remind what's about gapping lead?
It's roughly the order magnitude is 10 Kelvin.
Uh-huh. So this black curve is.
The black curve is just lead on lead. Sorry, this is normal state tip. So it's just the on the lead without the substrate, without the chain.
Is it Kelvin or TCs?
What's the gap in?
Yeah, I think it should be here because 0.5.
No, this was TC. Sorry, right, I'll take the right factor of, it's not a BCS, probably not exactly BCS, so I don't remember what the factor is. Was it 3.5 or something?
I think it's about 3 millivolts. And actually, here it says, this one shows 2 millivolts probably.
2 millivolts,
So proximity induced gap in iron seems to be same order.
Well, can we get
But
after that, I mean, there's very little of a gap at all. It's almost go straight through.
Okay, yeah.
I actually would be very careful with, we can discuss this in the end. Here, I'm not sure that where I would put the gap. So they put a gap, actually. Well, maybe I do have the traces. I don't know. They put a gap somewhere at 100 to 200 200 to 300 microelectron volts. That's what they extract from their data. For this, actually, one of the points of this paper that I mentioned in the beginning, the experimental one by Katharina Franke, is that there's additional structures below this energy, and it might well be that the induced gap is actually smaller than that if one interprets this in the Majorana framework in the first place.
Question?
Yes.
At what temperature are these data taken?
It's all 1 Kelvin. Okay, so they also did superconducting tips. And let me just briefly show that as well. So this is from 0 bias up to 2 millielectron volts. And there is no 0 bias peak. But there is a peak at voltage equal to the gap of the tip, and that's actually what one should expect. We might get back to that if time allows. And then there are again additional features at higher energies. And so this is perhaps maybe let me do this. There was also a recent experiment, a couple of maybe a month ago or two, from Basel, in which they more or less did very much very similar things. And they looked at the same system, but they also use a superconducting tip. And they then found this zero bias peak and claimed that this was very strong evidence for Majoranas. For this start, it's actually exactly different, quite different from what Ali Yazdani is saying. They have, for superconducting tip, they have a peak, as I said, at the gap of the tip, and not at zero. So I might get back to that as well. Good. So perhaps for the entertainment, it's kind of as all my Majorana experiments, this has a... this also got some press, and this article had a nice picture of the authors, and then it had this rocket, and it says "artist's conception of an antimatter rocket," which I thought it was kind of cute. Do you take Majoranas, which are zero energy quasi particles, and try to use that to propel anything? That's somewhat hard to do. Anyway, so. To make this the first question that I would like to address somewhat more concrete, as we saw, these Majorana states are, possible Majorana states, are localized on the scale of 1 nanometer in the experiment. And on the other hand, people had this belief that they should really be, and quite reasonable belief, that they should really be localized on the scale of the coherence length of the induced superconductivity along the chain. And if you estimate that, or if you just write the formula for that, then that's just the Fermi velocity divided by the gap that you're inducing, the topological gap or the induced gap. Now, you would expect that the topological gap is definitely at best as large as the gap of the underlying superconductor of the lead. And then this localization length should actually be at least comparable to or larger than the lead coherence length. And the lead coherence length is of the order of 100 nanometers. So why these Majoranas are so localized compared to expectations was one of the main mysteries initially of this experiment. So this is really a factor of 10 to the 2 difference between expectations and observation. And this was pointed out very quickly. So for example, in a paper by Dasalma that appeared very quickly afterwards, and you have to look at version 1, otherwise you won't find it. then it says, in particular, the observation of the precise localization of the Majorana zero mode at the wire ends cannot be reconciled with the extremely small topological superconducting gap. Small gap makes large localization length. And Patrick Lee wrote something in his, he wrote a small piece on this in this online journal club for condensed matter. And he said, we believe that this short distance physics, the strong localization, is not yet fully understood. But the long distance behavior must still be controlled by the coherence length. So the first thing that I want to address is just this puzzle. Why can we understand why this Majorana localization length is so small compared to what people expect? And with that, I'm basically done with this. What do I do to turn off the beamer? The other one? This one? Okay, so actually it turns out that I think that there's a... let me start more or less with a simple discussion of... the S-wave proximity effect, and we'll see that actually maybe when we should have realized this, and there's nothing terribly new in this, but... no one looked at this carefully enough. So if you look at this equation for the coherence length and look at where you could do something, h-bar seems pretty fixed, and we cannot do anything about it. The induced gap is also pretty fixed, or at least it cannot be larger than the gap of the underlying superconductor. So the only thing that we may want to have a chance to play with is this Fermi velocity. So let me see whether we can get this to be much smaller than what one would naively assume. So to do this, let's take a wire that is sitting on the superconductor, let's ask what an excitation is that is at an energy below the gap of the superconductor, how that would propagate along this wire. This wire is, of course, strongly coupled to the superconductor. And what will happen is that this excitation, this electron, will actually virtually enter the superconductor. An energy scale or time scale associated with this, which is just the strength of the coupling between the wire and the superconductor. And the strength of the coupling we can parameterize in terms of some tunneling amplitude for going from the wire into the superconductor, and the density of states, the normal state density of states of the superconductor. So this sort of gives the scale of how fast we are virtually entering, the electron is virtually entering into the superconductor. And then it will spend some time in the superconductor, loosely speaking, and eventually go back. And the time that it spends in the superconductor is going to be given by the characteristic energy scale of the superconductor, which is the gap. This excitation is actually spending only, again, loosely speaking, only a small fraction of time in the superconductor, in the wire. And that fraction of time is just given by, if I assume that gamma is larger than delta for reasons that I'll explain in a second, then this fraction of time is just given by the ratio of these energy scales, delta over gamma. And now, if I make the bold assumption that I'll justify in a second, that the this excitation is actually only moving along the wire when it is in the wire and not when it is in the superconductor, then you would actually have a Fermi velocity, every normalized Fermi velocity that is just reduced compared to the bare Fermi velocity in the wire by this ratio of these energy scales. And if you then, just before I justify this more carefully, put in numbers, I already said that delta was something, give or take this factor, of the order of 10 Kelvin, and gamma is, that's sort of atomic physics energy scale, because this in the Aslani experiment, because these iron atoms are actually sitting, they're really strongly embedded in the lead substrate, and so this, you presumably say, is something order of magnitude given by an electron volt. So if you put in these numbers, you actually get a reduction of the Fermi velocity by three orders of magnitudes. Okay? And then this is actually more than we need. I said we needed two orders of magnitudes. Now we got three. But that at least goes in the right direction. So that's sort of the heuristic argument for this. Now let me go through and maybe convince you slightly more theoretically that this actually makes sense and is essentially. The correct way of looking at it. So we want to look at the propagation of an electron in the wire. Let's look at the Green's function of the electron in the wire, and it's going to look something like this. It's omega minus some linear dispersion, linearized at the Fermi energy. It's a superconductor, so we should have a tau z factor Pauli matrix for electrons and holes. We want to do the whole thing in Bogoliubov-Degen, so we have to have the whole complement for the electrons as well. And then we take account of the superconductor simply through the self-energy. So there's some self-energy as a function of K and omega. And this self-energy going to be t squared times this sum over all the transverse momenta, because we're having a 1D wire sitting on a 3D superconductor. The Green's function of the superconductor of k and omega, and that's something that's been calculated many times. Let me just give you the answer and convince you that this is a reasonable answer. This is what you find, including in papers of Patrick Lee on this subject, since I had his quote earlier. This is what you find for this. So the first thing that you may want to check is that if the energy is much larger than delta, then you're just having an excitation that can decay into a normal system. Then if omega is much larger than delta, this just gives you I times omega. Superconductivity, we can skip. The omega cancels against this omega, and you just get I times gamma. So that sounds plausible. Sort of checks. Second thing is that it's k independent. So remember that I said that the electron was only moving along the wire when it is in the wire, and it's not propagating the superconductor. This basically means that the effect of the superconductor is entirely local. Wherever the electron enters into the superconductor, it also comes back out, same spot. So this sort of justifies these words. And the reason for this is that the dependence on kx is very weak after you're integrating over all the transverse momenta. So that's also okay. And and otherwise, let's do perhaps simplify this a little bit and look now at what's happening far below the gap. So let's take omega less than delta.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Do you have a delta instead of gamma in front of Rx?
No, sorry, yes, I have the gamma here. Yes, thanks, sorry, yeah. So let's now look at what's happening if you're far below the gap. Then it's a real self-energy because you're just virtually entering into the superconductor. You cannot decay, so there's no imaginary part. And with this correction that we just had, this is minus gamma over delta times omega plus, no, also minus, and then omega small delta goes cancels against delta, and we get delta tau x. Okay. So at first sight, now you would say that, wow, this is amazing. We're getting a gap, the prefactor of tau x that is much that can possibly be much bigger than delta, because gamma is a factor that can you have under control. And of course, that just has to be nonsense. And the reason that this is nonsense is because you also have this factor. And if gamma is larger than delta, then the prefactor of the omega simply becomes very large. And so this means that this omega gets a much larger prefactor, and that's usually taken care of by introducing a quasi-particle weight into the Green's function, and that we should do that. And so if you do this, this one looks and then we have z times gamma times tau x, and z is 1 over 1 plus gamma over delta. And that, of course, actually makes eminent sense because, as we just argued before, the electron is actually having very little spectral weight in the wire and a lot of spectral weight in the superconductor if gamma becomes large. So this should have a very small spectral weight, as it does. If gamma is much larger than delta, this is just delta over gamma, and is very small. But what you also see is that it has two additional effects. The first one is that the induced gap, and for that you should really take this and not this. This is now z times gamma, and if z is delta over gamma for large gamma, then this just becomes delta as it should be. So that far, I think, was perfectly well appreciated by everyone. What apparently was much less appreciated is that now we also have a Fermi velocity that is renormalized by the same factor. And which is just the same one that we got from the heuristic argument. And if you now look at what the characteristic length is from this Green's function, the coherence length of this induced superconductivity, you just take the characteristic k so that these two terms become of the same order. Then you have psi, also it's just h bar zvf divided by z gamma. And so the z's actually cancel. And you see that if you use the original Fermi velocity, the unrenormalized one, then you should actually, the denominator has the strength of the coupling, which is much, much bigger than the delta. So this is much smaller than the coherence length of the lead. So the surprise, perhaps, is that if you plot the induced gap as a function of gamma, and somewhere here is delta, then initially the induced gap is just increasing with the strength of the coupling, but eventually it saturates to the gap of the substrate. If you plot xi of the induced superconductivity, and say here there is xi of the underlying proximity-providing superconductor, then for small gamma, the gap is small, so it has some 1 over the gap dependence, but this does not saturate. This just keeps going and doesn't end at the coherence length of the lead. And so that at least goes in the right direction. This induced, this coherence length from the proximity effect is simply much smaller than what was assumed in these comments that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, maybe it should. Distance between the impurities too. Yeah, so.
Say it again?
Second, the shorter, so it's the distance between ions.
Between the, yeah, I mean, so far I still have a wire, so so far I don't have that at all.
Right.
Okay, so that's just a little bit of proximity effect. So now let's check whether this actually, how to get this into the theory for these ad atoms. So now let's get back to the ad atoms and try to describe that. So what we have is a bunch of these iron atoms sitting on the lead. And the way that I would like to describe them, we see that there was this magnetism. I don't want to really deal with iron and the fact that it's D levels, but that's a minimal approach is to take an Anderson impurity for each one of these ad atoms. So so just spin 1/2. So there's just a spin up and a spin down state. And let's just deal. So, and then there's hopping. There's hopping between these ad atoms, so they are, I mean, atomically close, so there will be some hybridization, some hopping between neighboring ad atoms, and then there's the hybridization with the superconducting substrate, and I already introduced this hopping strength T for that. And then we, since it's Anderson impurities, there is some on-site Hubbard repulsion, and we'll just make a following Anderson, just make a mean field decoupling of this and assume that there is ferromagnetic order in the chain. So we will not calculate this self-consistently, but simply assume that this is actually the case. So if we decouple this, then we get the following. Where NJ is just NJ up plus NJ down, so that's the average occupation of the site, and MJ is the average magnetization of the site. So this is NJ up minus NJ down, okay? And with this decoupling, this one just renormalizes the energy of these D levels, quasi-D levels sitting on the iron atoms. And this is basically acting like a Zeeman field locally on these ad atoms and splits the spin up and the spin down states.
Is it known what's the spin of the iron atom on the surface?
Of a single one?
Yeah, single one. What's the?
I'm not exactly sure. I'm also not sure how relevant it is if you take the entire chain, because they do talk to each other very strongly. And
but presumably we'll get to the, some high spin. Or
it's some high, it's presumably, I don't know, two. I don't know. I don't think it's known what happens on that. At least I don't know it. Maybe someone else.
So Felix, if you make gamma really large.
Yes.
Compared to the gap, do you still have this interpretation of it as an actual nanowire sitting up there? I mean, like, doesn't this description break down at some point when gamma gets too large?
Well, I mean, this description is exactly accounting for the superconductor, right? You're just taking, it's a Green's function. I mean, it's a single particle Hamiltonian, basically. Except for BCS, and you're accounting for the coupling to the superconductor, which is 3D, and all we're doing, and this, the Green's function just accounted exactly for this coupling to the 3D superconductor, so I think it should be...
In principle, there is some...
And on top of it, maybe more physical answer is that the superconductor is gapped, so at least subgap energy, so that still makes it a 1D. Physics.
And in principle, there's, we get some lambda F and wire is some kind of cutoff, like this. This is fermi violence in the wire.
Yes.
The probably is still some kind of short length cutoff.
Yeah, sure.
Or psi. So whether psi can just shorter than.
Yeah. So I think at one point, we linearize the dispersion,
right.
And so these things certainly you have to be taken into account. Yes, so
yes,
certainly
probably,
lambda
yes.
F is
lambda to infinity is something.
Okay.
But maybe getting back to Parsi's question, maybe the question is whether this psi that you extract from the Green's function, whether you expect that to really be the length scale of the Majorana bound state.
Right. So that's why I'm doing the actual chain. Right. I mean, you could stop here and say we're happy now, but let's model the chain, and at least and the one assumption that we'll make is this mean field assumption. But beyond from that, it's basically just a calculation, and the upshot will be that you just solve finite chains numerically, and you plot these Majorana wave functions, and they fit this just perfectly. We have to still be a little bit careful about what the induced gap does. That so far, there was no spin orbit in the story. It was just a pure S-wave superconductivity. So there's one little caveat to this. But basically, the story just carries through completely.
I guess one could imagine that maybe, if gamma is big enough, you actually should resolve the cell consistency for the BCS in the bulk.
Yeah. Yeah. So we
completion in there.
Absolutely, and we did not do that.
But the boundary should not affect the bulk of the S-wave supercomputer.
So
it will just suppress some structure, but it's not going to affect the bulk gap in the supercomputer.
Sure, but you're tunneling into the boundary.
Yeah, so there
so be locally the gap may have some more structure from compared to what we've assumed. But so we did not study this. I agree with that.
It may deform the order parameter near the boundary.
Yeah.
Well, quarter parameter near the boundary.
Yeah.
Might change it. It might change it at the boundary.
Yes.
Like change the symmetry. Because we have spin orbit at the boundary.
Okay, so we left the superconductor homogeneous. Let's be optimistic first that these things work out. Anyway, so this mean we do this mean field assumption, and now we can basically now it's a single particle problem that is easily solved, and you can solve it basically analytically in various limits. So if we now first of all look at a single impurity, then we have this local moment formation. So in some sense, there is a occupied, say, spin up level and an empty spin down level. And this is the Fermi energy of the substrate of the lead, and now we can look at, in principle, two limits. So remember that there's this hopping between the neighboring iron chains. So one possibility is, not iron chains, but iron atoms. So what will happen is that these states will broaden out into bands. So one possibility is something like this, where this hopping is relatively weak, and we are having just a light, small corrugation as a function of wave vector of these bands, small bandwidth. And the other possibility is that these bandwidths are actually rather large. So start here, and so we might have a situation roughly like this and like this. And so these two limits are obviously somewhat different, although I will at least state in the second that basically they do the same sort of physics. But this sort of makes it totally obvious that this is a fantastic system for topological superconductivity, because we have a single spin polarized band at the Fermi energy of the superconductor, and it's perfectly spin polarized. So it's very close to this Kitaev type of chain physics, right? Because if these states are asymmetric, which will generically be the case, then this one is just completely occupied and it's not part of the game. So as long as you have only a single or an odd number of these bands crossing the Fermi energy, then this should be very conducive for topological superconductivity. And the range and parameters over which you have this are basically atomic energy scales. So that's quite useful. So you can now go through and actually do the phase diagrams of this, just based on solving the single particle physics. And so they look something like this. I want to draw this. So here is the strength, the bandwidth, basically, of these iron bands. So it's the strength of this hopping. And let's plot here the energy. So whenever you have an individual impurity, you form a bound state in the gap. And let's take the strength of this coupling, the gamma, basically, and parameterize it to the energy of the Schieber state. If this coupling is very weak, then the Schieber state is close to the gap edge. And if it gets stronger, it moves down and may even move through zero to negative values. And so when we are in this limit, the hopping between the iron atoms is zero. So that's sort of this limit, where there's very little, the bandwidth is very small. And if we go move over here, then we get into this limit where the bandwidth of these iron bands is large. And let's first, let's just plot the relevant one. So the phase diagram looks like something like this, where all of this is basically in this topological phase that has Majorana bound state at its ends. If you have this situation, then you need rather strong hybridization so that the Schieber states have to be in the center of the gap. Here somewhere is minus delta. Whereas if you are at large W, then eventually you have a single band overlapping with the Fermi energy, and you have very robust topological superconductivity. This, again, is a range of atomic energy scales, not anything related to superconductivity. And this point, is where the first band, this band, crosses to the Fermi energy, and this point is where also this band crosses the Fermi energy. So then you have, again, two modes at the Fermi energy, and then so an even number of bands, and then you lose the topological superconductivity. And it's probably most reasonable to, if you to put the experiment somewhere in this region where you have really robust topological superconductivity.
So, but again, it's a simplification of the real situation, right? Because you have d electrons on each spin, many of them.
Yes.
So they might form multiple bands.
Right. So this is just the difference here is between even and odd.
Right.
And so if you have multiple bands, there's a difference between an even number and an odd number of bands.
Can I ask a question here about the Sheba states?
Yes.
So how would you distinguish, you know, when you see in the experiment, when you get these zero energy bound states,
right.
How do you distinguish them from Sheba states?
Okay, can I get, I'm not sure whether I'll manage. So first of all, Sheba states, well, they might by accident happen to be at the end of the at the end of the chain, but in principle they could appear everywhere along the chain. That's one thing. And then there are ways of distinguishing them that I might have a chance to mention or not, but probably not. I'll tell you afterwards. So basically with superconducting tips, there are nice ways of telling them apart in principle. But it's a problem. I agree with you. Okay, so now.
So by Sheba states, you mean just state at finite energy?
No, that's
at the end.
In non-Majorana bound state in the center of the gap. You know, that can happen.
At zero energy, accidental.
If you, that could in principle.
I mean, typically, even you have magnetic impurities, they do arise.
Right.
And here, you know, you have a magnetic impurity.
Right, it's up here, but not the zero energy, not the zero energy.
Which usually you find.
Right.
So what we can also do with this is then to get the subgap spectrum, which is also a band. And so this is the k-axis. This is some energy of subgap. States, and if you're somewhere here, quote unquote, then this has roughly the following structure. I just something like this. Just qualitatively, this is what it looks like. So, and it's the way to think about this is that these are the points where, imagine you're not coupled to the superconductor, then you have just these dispersions, and they run through the Fermi energy. So these would be running here. And they're very steep because it's the large Fermi velocity on the scale of the gap of the superconductor. So we have these are these very rapid dispersions, and basically these are the leftovers of this rapid dispersion. And then we have these two regions where the energy, it's not as constant as I drew it, but it's sort of almost constant. And these are basically, you can think of as Sheba states coming from different sections of the dispersions. So basically this is sort of the k equals zero Sheba state that comes from the fact that here you have lots of states sitting there. And this one is sort of the k equal pi Sheba state that comes from the fact that here you have lots of states sitting there, and they have different exchange couplings, so they have different energies just because they are in at different distances from the Fermi energy of the superconductor. So this sort of interpolates between the pure wire picture with these linear dispersions and the Sheba states, with this one being Sheba parts and this one being wire dispersions. And you can then calculate how the dispersion looks like in the vicinity of these crossing points at low energies. And again, if you just take the upspin level to minus infinity, you can just evaluate it all analytically, and then you find for this dispersion, I guess I used epsilon of k, it's plus or minus, and then there is delta over gamma Li Vf delta k, everything squared plus delta, and there's some, let's call it delta Li over Li squared. And this is exactly what we had before. So this Li, we can just ignore. That's just, it's essentially one, or within the accuracy of the talk. So this is exactly this renormalization of the Fermi velocity that we derived earlier. So basically, the way you see this is that these slopes here are very strongly reduced compared to the slopes of the bare of the bare wire dispersions or the bare aditon dispersions, and then there's the induced gap, and the induced gap now is not only given by delta, but it also has this factor, and this is basically a measure of the strength of the spin orbit coupling in the system, because we're now coupling to a perfectly spin polarized system, and so if there was no spin orbit coupling, there would be no induced gap at all, and so in general the maximum gap in this case is the bare gap times the strength of the spin orbit coupling, and it's smaller than that, and this is basically the reason why we have, that's the induced gap, this is the topological gap of this structure. And
Felix, yeah. So what is known about spin orbit coupling in lead? Is it Rajba type, is it something else?
I think it needs to be Rajba type, because actually, otherwise it's not going to help you with so because of inversion symmetry. So I think it would have to be Rajba type spin orbit. Then there were some ab initio calculations of this of Alan McDonald, and they estimate that you get something of 100 microelectron volts, but I don't know how reliable this number is.
Yes. So. What do people know about the bare velocity Vf? That's a bare velocity of the ion atoms.
Yeah, so we never, so Alan also calculated gamma to start with, and he claims he also puts one electron volt there. That's for whatever it's worth, I don't know. And about Vf, I don't know. I mean, if I want to make an estimate, I would put into it a just a standard metallic Fermi velocity, 10 to the 6 meters per second, because it's metallic atoms sitting in atomic distances from one another. That would be, but more than that, I don't know. But that would be my naive assumption for that. Okay. So now, now we can actually. We can look at the Majorana localization, and so we have psi of the wire divided by psi lead, and so we already saw that we had one factor delta over gamma that we had from the renormalization of the Fermi velocity, but now we see that there's also a factor from the fact that the induced gap is smaller than the bare gap, so there's this delta over delta induced, and so we, I mean, this was 10 to the minus 3, and this is definitely larger than 1. Now it's anyone's guess what this number is, but 10 to the 2 is certainly as good as any result for this. So it's at least in principle consistent. And by the way, it also suggests that all the other peaks that you see are basically the Van Hoff singularities of these band structures. That would be the interpretation in this picture. There's the coherence peak, but then there are additional peaks coming from these flat parts of this dispersion. So and in some measurements, at least, there are more or less three extra peaks coming up.
Why do they have to be flat?
Pardon?
Why do they have to be flat? I mean, you can get it, but
no, this is, I'm oversimplifying. It's not a PowerPoint presentation, so you have to give me the freedom to emphasize the main points. But they tend to be relatively flat compared to these sections, or quite flat compared to these, because they come from this very strong wire dispersions.
And it's one dimensional. So the other direction is flat because.
No, it's one D. This is a 1D band structure. No, that's not. It's just let me see. Do I have a good argument for
them? Levels cannot get out from the gap.
There's level repulsion from here. Right. That's one thing. It still doesn't. I mean, it's made of parameters. You can make them smooth and you can make them flat. What looked like the more relevant parameters, they tend to be quite remarkably flat.
If you look at the experimental data, it seems like there's a really big peak, which should come from that type of Van Hove.
Yes.
And if you, based on this, you have a parabolic band, right? So parabolic-like. At the boundary, yes, you've got a pi by a, and you've got that flatness.
But I'm okay. So maybe since I'm out of time, let me just. There's this experiment. Maybe that's a fine, good place to stop. This experiment that Katharina Franke did, basically, she takes this. This was delta tip. This is superconducting tip now. This is the I dV, and this is the bias. There was this these various peaks, and she just basically looks at this this tip at this peak, and if you plot it not portrait but you plot it landscape and enlarge it a little bit, it looks a lot like there's maybe one peak at zero, but there is almost certainly also another peak at a finite energy. And so all I'm trying to say with this, and so this was 100 microelectron volts in this experiment, so much below the energy where Ali saw any other peaks. So all I'm trying to say is that the resolution of the data is not terribly high. And Ali, I think, also had low temperature data that I've never seen, where there are more peaks coming up. So don't believe that what you see as one peak in these data is necessarily just one peak if you really resolve things in there.
To the Ali's data, not the superconducting
data.
If you look at Ali's data, you have, you know, depending on the position, in yes. certain positions you have a subgap, which looked like what you're saying. There's a very
right.
small gap.
Yes.
And then after that, there was it's very asymmetric, which is probably due to the position of the chains that he's choosing. But there was one side on the right side, it's rather really singular.
Right.
Which is below the original gap. And this is very
right.
large.
Yes.
And this should come from something
and
like
this
what
may
you're
come from,
here,
from
some
right.
gap spectrum.
Yeah, yeah, right. And then maybe he
there has to be some type of flatness in certain momentum space. And
yes,
I'm asking where that's coming from. Like in your pictures, it's just like cosine bend, you probably won't get it. Probably to some
No, this is coming straight out of these calculations, these plots. And then I'm just plotting them sort of schematically, but there's a natural reason for why they are this comes from this very steep dispersion of these original iron bands,
yeah.
right? And but these they go out of the gap very rapidly, right? And there's a huge region in case. Where there is no iron states to start with, and where you're really talking about sort of Shiba-like states, and they just have a much weaker dispersion than these iron states, and that's why they're so flat. Okay.
So in the experiment, there might be also some high angular momentum channels of these Shiba impurities that are
in Yeah, and you know more about that than I do. The one thing that I can say about this, the one thing that Katharina also did was to look at a monomer and a dimer. And the monomer seems to have only a single, very weakly bound Shiba state. But the dimer already has peaks all over the gap. So there is clearly a lot of physics going on, even from going from monomer to dimer. And it's needs to be understood. I don't think anyone understands.
So in your Anderson inferiority model, the Hopping is nearest neighbor or Lagrange Hopping?
This Hopping is, if you assume, nearest neighbor. But of course, in principle, the electrons can also go into the superconductor, move in the superconductor, and come back. And this we do exactly. There is no approximation on that.
So then, when the red constant commensurate with the momentum, then there is strong dispersion due to the long rangeness of the Hopping, when the phasor or
because of this long,
I mean,
long
range the structure, there is a strong dispersion at finite k.
Yes.
That maybe come from the long range Hopping.
These strong dispersions?
Yeah.
No, they come from the fact that that these bands are crossing through the superconducting gap very, very rapidly at a huge Fermi velocity.
Okay.
Right? I mean, so they changed over the Bedouin zone, they changed by one electron volt. Here, we are plotting the Bedouin zone. This subgap spectrum changes over 10 Kelvin. So these things, they're extremely steep and cut very rapidly. And this is just the smoothed version of this because of this renormalization. These dispersions get reduced very substantially, but not all the way, unless you make gamma extremely strong. Any more questions? I'm in the discussion part. There's a second half of the talk that obviously I'm not going to give. And it's answering your question of how to distinguish these Majoranas from other just random zero energy states. And the one advertisement that I would like to make is that using superconducting tips has a lot of possibilities that normal state tips don't have. I think that should be something that these are simple experiments. The technology is there. So there might be some nice things to do there.